The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
Well, hello. It's a wonderful day, and I'm glad to have you here. This is Brian Mitchell, and welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. And as usual, I am your host. You know, I've been seeing a lot of crazy things on the internet lately. And I mean, actually, it's been going on for a little while now. But anybody can write anything on the internet. Anybody can say anything. And it doesn't mean it's right or wrong or legal or illegal or whatever. It's just that people just put stuff out there and not really knowing what they're saying. The latest thing that I've noticed, and this is specifically after the release or the public domain availability of Steamboat Willie, which is the first Mickey Mouse sound cartoon ever. It's from 1928, is that Ub Iwerks created the character, and Walt Disney had nothing to do with it. So I've been hearing a lot of this stuff, and it's a lot of made up mumbo jumbo. So the reason why I want to address this is because there's so much disinformation out there about a lot of different things, and people believe what they want to believe anyway. But I hope that most of our listeners are sensible enough to understand that the reason why Disney is Disney today is because of one person. And actually, you know, you could say, well, there are a lot of people involved with the making of these films. You know, had a lot of different talents. You had musical talents, you had animators, artists, actors, technicians, all these people working together to create a production. But the problem is that if you don't have somebody that is overseeing that, then basically, you know, you get a bunch of different things. You may not get everything in unison. The magic of a Walt Disney is this. Walt Disney was an idea guy. He didn't draw Cinderella. He didn't draw Pinocchio. He was not, maybe early in his career, he was animating. He always found people that could do these jobs better. But strictly, Walt Disney was an idea guy. So the idea started with him. The storyline also started with him. And people would also add to it. And he was the editor. You know, he would figure out what he was going to use and what he wasn't going to use. As far as Steamboat Willie goes, he conceived of the idea, but Ub Iwerks refined it, and he actually animated the character. But the idea behind it was Walt's. The idea of adding sound to the cartoon was Walt's. The idea of making the productions better and bigger and adding color and doing the first feature-length animated film, doing the first musical animated film in the fashion of a Fantasia. All these things, multiplane camera, you know, the idea started with Walt. Or maybe people around him might have come up with ideas, but he was the ultimate editor. He would say, yes, let's do that. That's a great idea. Or no, I don't like that. But he basically built this organization. You know, he, through blood, sweat, and tears, forming the Walt Disney Studio with his brother Roy, and then soldiering on. And the reason why that studio was so successful was because there was a brain behind it, and the brain was Walt's. And so when you hear somebody say Steamboat Willie, well, yeah, he didn't animate it. Well, the reality is, you know, with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, there are a lot of animators, okay? There are a lot of animators, there are a lot of assistants, there are a lot of great technicians, there are great music people behind the scenes. But basically, the vision has to start somewhere. It's one person that starts that. And that was Walt Disney. So without Walt Disney, there would be no Mickey Mouse. There would be no Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs as we know it. There wouldn't be a Cinderella or Disneyland or Walt Disney World or Mary Poppins or all these films that came after, because there would be no Walt Disney Company. Walt Disney was the creator of all of this world of magic. So I just am trying to put this to bed, because there's a lot of people just saying stuff and they don't know anything about it. But Walt Disney himself called himself the, well, maybe he did not call himself this, but I've heard this reference too. So he's been compared to the conductor of this wonderful symphony orchestra. And those people recognize the genius of Walt. And if you listen to interviews with Milt Kahl or Ward Kimball or Frank Thomas, Ollie Johnston, and there's an excellent documentary about Frank and Ollie, they basically acknowledge that Walt Disney was the man. He was the guy to push this stuff forward. He had the dreams, the vision, and the, the stick-to-itiveness to make all this stuff happen. So it's just a reality. It's the truth. And you don't have to take my word for it. There's so many people that work for Disney that will acknowledge that. And you can get all that information through all these different books and filmed interviews and stuff like that. We have on a gentleman today who is basically, he's a historian and an author, and he's an editor, and he's put together a lot of these interviews and articles over the years. He's put them into books, and he's done a fantastic job with that. And it's so important that the information gets out there, and people need to read. You need to read if you don't believe that Walt Disney was not the ultimate creator of all the stuff that came out. So the person that's on today, very important gentleman, his name is Didier Gez, and I'm glad to have him on. We're going to have him on in just a minute. Stay tuned. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, classic animated cartoons with your host animator, Brian Mitchell. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
Well, well, well. Today we're talking about Disney. And we're talking about Disney with a very knowledgeable gentleman. He, like I said before, he's written a lot of books. He has a website where he points to all the new books that are coming out at DDRGez.com. I'm really glad to have him on today. Please welcome Disney historian and author, Mr. Didier Gez. Hi, Didier. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for coming on. It's a pleasure. So I think it's great. You know, there's so many historians out there, but there are a select few that really, really kind of know about all this stuff. And, you know, they try to get the facts out there. They try to keep it straight. And Jim Corcus is one of them. John Kanemaker is another. I mean, so many. And then, but you've done some incredible work getting all this information out. You're a big Disney fan, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. I've been all my life since I was a kid. Absolutely.
How young? When did you discover that you really into all this Disney stuff? How'd that all start up?
Well, listen, I was born in 1973, and when I was 5 years old, my parents, and I was born in France, I was born in Paris, and my parents, when I was five, decided to go to Disneyland in California and to discover Disneyland for the very first time in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I say their lives because they didn't take myself or my brother with them, but they came back with a lot of things from the 50th anniversary of Mickey Mouse from 1978.
Wow.
And he brought that back, and I loved those gifts. And I grew up in Paris. You discovered Disney really reading Disney comic books. this is really the first way you get in touch with these new characters, is with comic books. That's true in France, that's true in Italy, that's true in Germany. And so that's how I discovered Disney first. And I love those comic books. Every one of the comic books that later on I discovered was drawn by fantastic artists like Hal Barthes or Floyd Gottfredson and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's how I grew up. And then obviously I discovered Disney shorts and animated features, the shorts on TV. And the animated features in cinemas. And I think the first movie that I went to see with my parents was Pinocchio. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up with all of that. And then when I became a teenager, I realized, oh my God, there are artists who are doing all of this. There are real artists who are behind all of that. I wonder if I could meet some of them. And obviously I was still in Paris and or in Geneva, Switzerland at some point. And so there was no easy access. It wasn't like being in California and saying, you know, they're nearby. No, it wasn't the case. Right. However, I was very lucky because at that point I was back in Paris and the Disney Studios had opened a subsidiary in Paris, or just near Paris, in the city of Montreuil, right on the periphery of Paris.
That's right.
And I thought, oh my, this is really interesting. That means that there are now Disney artists who are actually in Paris. I wonder if I could meet some of them. And so I contacted the studio. I was, I think, 16 or 17 at the time. Mm-hmm. I contacted the studio and I said, you know, I do articles for American magazine called Animation Magazine. And of course, that magazine had never heard of me before. They didn't know I was doing that.
Right.
And I said, and I would love to interview the heads of the new studio in Paris. And I knew they were two twin brothers, the Brizzi brothers.
Brizzi brothers, right.
Mm-hmm. And that they were French, so that was important to me at the time because my English wasn't very good at the time. And I said, I would love to interview them. And they said, you know what? They said, yes, absolutely. We would love to have you over and we'd be glad for you to interview them. So I did. I interviewed them. And then I got a friend to translate that article in English for me, that interview in English for me, because my English wasn't good enough at the time. And it took a long time for him to do that. And I was like, damn, this is never going to happen again. Next time, I'm going to be the one translating that. I need to improve my English. So that was extra motivation to speak better English. And I sent that interview to Animation Magazine. And believe it or not, they came back to me. And remember, that was before the internet, so you had to wait like weeks before you got an answer.
Yes.
Especially if we came from the US. And they came back to me and they said, we have been looking for a piece to release in our magazine about the new studio, and this is perfect timing. We would love to run your interview. And so they did. And that was my first released interview about Disney. And
wow,
so
very neat. That was kind of fun. Very neat. What year was that when you went to see them? It had to be the late 80s, right?
It was the late 80s, I believe. Yeah, that's right.
Now, I know Glenn Keane worked there for like a year or two, but I don't know if he was there at that time.
Well, not right at that time, but there are a few funny stories, which is right after I interviewed the Brizzi brothers, I was walking around what's called Disney Village, right outside of Disneyland Paris, the sort of the shopping area, like downtown Disney, if you want.
Right.
And I was in one of the stores there, and I see a guy with a satchel on his shoulder that says, Walt Disney Feature Animation France. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. It must be someone working at the studio in Montreuil. So I look at him a little bit better, and I'm like, oh my God, I recognize him from some bonus features on VHS. Mm-hmm. And it was Andreas Deja, the animator behind Jafar and Scar and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And so I went to talk to him, and I said, are you Andreas Deja? And of course, he looks at me like, who are you? And especially, how do you recognize me? Like, I'm not this big celebrity. How on earth? And so I started explaining to him that I was really passionate about the history of Disney and that I really admire his work and so on and so forth. And I asked him if he would agree to be interviewed. And so he said yes. And I spent hours after all that interviewing him at his place in Paris.
Right.
A few years later, and Andreas at the time was working, I believe, on Runaway Brain in Paris.
That's great.
And then a few
great
years
short.
Later, and then a few years later, Glenn Keane went to work at the studio in Paris, and he was working on Tarzan at the time. And so, of course, having interviewed Andreas, I had to also interview Glenn Keane. And so I asked for the authorization to come and interview him. And after a few months, they said, yeah, we'd love to have you here, and we'd love to get you to interview him. And I did. And so, yes, I did have the chance to meet him in Paris.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. When did you? How long were you in Paris? How long did you stay before coming here to the States?
Oh, that's a fairly complicated story. So I grew up in Paris. I then lived for 8 years in Paris when I was a kid, then 8 years in Geneva, Switzerland, then came back to Paris, and then to make a really long story short, during my studies, I spent a year in Oxford, a year in Madrid, and back to Paris. And then when I started my career, I started working for Disney, believe it or not. And I ended up working for Disney for 10 years in a very non-creative, very commercial position. And the first 4 years were in Paris, but then I moved for Disney to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and then to Sao Paulo, Brazil, and then to Madrid, Spain. And then after 8 years in Madrid, Spain, in 2012, I moved with my wife to the United States.
Wow.
No longer working for Disney. In the middle, in between, went to work for Warner Bros. And then moved to the U.S. for NBC Universal.
Right.
But that was really for work reasons. And so we've been in the U.S. for now a little bit more than 10 years. And I've become American citizens just a few months ago, and we love it here in Miami, here in Coral Gables. So,
very good. Congratulations. Did you visit any of the? I'm sure you've been to Disney World since, right?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Since we arrived, yeah, absolutely. We've been to Walt Disney World quite a few times, and before we moved to the U.S., my parents had taken my brother and I to Walt Disney World and then to Disneyland. Couple of times,
right? Mm-hmm. Which parks do you like better?
Now, it's a trick question.
It is a trick question, but hey, you know, it's you may like aspects of different areas at different parks. You know, you might like one part of Disneyland, but may not like the rest of it because it's because of the way it's laid out or whatever. I don't know.
So if I take the three. The four resorts that I know, which are the one in Paris, the one in Florida, the one in California, and the one in Tokyo, I would say that the two parks with the most amount of details are Disneyland Paris and Tokyo DisneySea.
So you were saying the top two are Disneyland Paris for you as far as detail goes, and then Tokyo Disneyland.
Tokyo DisneySea.
DisneySea, right. I heard it's terrific. I've never been there, but I heard it's wonderful. So what were you saying after that? I kind of lost you there.
Sure. And the park which for me has the most soul, the most emotion to an extent is Disneyland California, because there is still a lot of Walt in there. Walt is still very much in spirit there. And then obviously I love Walt Disney World because there is so much to do and there is so much to discover and it's just fun. I just love Hollywood Studios. I love Animal Kingdom. I love Epcot. And yes, the Magic Kingdom has a few things in there that are not anywhere else. So yeah, it's very hard to pick.
Right. I get you. I've been to just Disneyland and Walt Disney World. Walt Disney World is just, it goes on forever. It's just so much to do between recreational activities and then the parks. And what was funny was the last time I've been there, the Hollywood Studio, I've never, ever really liked Hollywood Studios. It just felt it was a kind of a ripoff of the Universal Studio Tour in California, but doing it the Disney way. And it didn't seem like it was a full day park. It was always like a half day park because it really wasn't much. It was, you know, you did the studio tour, you did the animation tour, which I loved. And then you had maybe a couple of shows and then Star Tours. Star Tours was there. And the park is totally transformed. It's a totally different park now. It's really amazing with all the stuff that they have now. You know, Tower of Terror and Rock and Roller Coaster and the Star Wars Land and all this other stuff that they've put in there. And it is now, I think it's one of the main draws now in Florida. And the same thing goes with Animal Kingdom. I never felt that it was a full day park. It felt like it was a half day park and a zoo, like a glorified zoo. But they've transformed that as well. So that is now it's a great park. It's really come a long way. So, but I have to agree with you on Disneyland because it kind of has more of a fairy tale quality to it because everything is kind of in miniature, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you go through there, it's not a huge park. I think it's only, 60 acres? Maybe 50 or 60 acres. It's not very big, but everything is kind of put together in a way that you can, it seems like it's a much bigger park, but you can really get through it from one end to the other. You can do it in maybe 5 minutes, which things like Storybook Land are very Walt inspired. And I'm trying to think of some of the other stuff that they have there that's unique to the place. You know, of course, Main Street is really Walt, you know. Mm. So a lot of wonderful things about that. Anyway, just getting back to, with the detail, when you went to Disney Sea in Tokyo Disney Sea, what's the most striking thing about that park to you?
Well, again, I mean, there are a couple of things. One, there were quite a few attractions that do not exist anywhere else. And so that was obviously very, very fun for my wife and I to experience. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing is, and this was really funny, when I was researching my book on Disneyland Paris, I was talking with Imagineers at the time in the late 1990s, who were also working, amazing with Tokyo DisneySea, because we go and present our ideas to Oriental Land Company. And whenever we present our ideas and the budget, they come back to us and they say, you need to increase the budget. And we're like, this is the only project for which we're hearing that. Like, usually it is, you need to cut this and that, and you need to reduce the budget by this and that. Mm. You're like, no, this is the only project where they keep saying, increase the budget, add more details, do it even better. And so that's really reflected in that park.
Right. I've heard about that. I heard the fact that they're really pushing the quality over there, and it's not so much Disney pushing it. It's that company that's pushing it, which is great. It's great.
That's right.
It's almost it is in the spirit of what Walt Disney would try to do. And I know they kept, you know, the bean counters over at Disney kept trying to cut the budgets on some of the attractions that Walt was building at the time. And he would just ignore them. He would just say, no, this is the way it has to be. So,
well, actually, you know, it is funny because you do interview quite a few people who will tell you it wasn't so much that Walt did not cut the budget. It's just that he managed to do it in a way that still preserved the quality of the attraction and even sometimes plused it. There's this fantastic story of, I believe it was Carl Bongiorno who shared that one with me. One of the top Imagineers, one of the heads of Imagineering for many years. And he said, and I don't know if it was him or someone else, but he said, Walt enters a budget meeting and he's there just with the bean counters, and the bean counters say, Walt, on this attraction, this is running over budget, and you need to find a way for your people to decrease the budget. And he says, well, leave it to me. And then he goes and see the Imagineers, and he's like, so this idea is fantastic. What if we improved it this way and that way and this other way and so on and so forth? Mm-hmm. And he has one of the bean counters or one of his top executives with him at that point. And when they go out of the room, the executive tells Walt, you realize what you just did, right? And Walt says, yeah, I know. I just reduced the budget by $2 million. but he also improved the quality of the attraction by doing that.
Right.
And so it's a wonderful approach. And,
right, yeah. Right. Well, yeah, it's not always about the money. It's about the creativity. So, you know, if you can boost it in one way and save some money, it's not a bad thing, right?
That's right.
Yeah. We were talking about Disneyland before. Disneyland, I would say, and because you were saying the soul of Walt Disney is in there, I think the fact that so many of Walt's animators were involved with Disneyland. And I mean, they were a little bit involved with Florida as well, but you know, you had Ken Anderson that was really involved with Disneyland.
And, yeah, he was really one of the first ones to get involved with Disneyland and the designing of Disneyland. And Ken had always been my favorite concept artist at Disney, one of my favorite artists at Disney. Mm-hmm. Walt called him his Jack of all trades, and there's obviously a reason for that. He was both a great animator at some point, but he was especially a great designer and a great concept artist, and then a fantastic Imagineer.
Yes.
And as soon as I had like a bit of extra money after starting to get a job in the late 1990s, the first thing I did was to go and buy a few original pieces by Ken Anderson.
Yes.
Not stuff from the old classics, because I could not afford that, but stuff from the Rescuers and the Aristocats and Pete's Dragon. I have a beautiful concept piece that he created for Elliot the Dragon.
Elliot, yeah.
Bolt, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, he was amazing. I was lucky enough to actually meet him. I had lunch with a bunch of Disney animators. I actually went with Walt Peregoy, who was working at the Blues Studio with me, and he invited me to go to the Dinosaur Club. And so that was over at Point of View, which used to be Alphonse's in Toluca Lake, California. And sat down for about an hour and a half, and Ken Anderson was at one end of the table, and Dale Bear was there, and Andreas was there, and it was fun. So.
And so if you met both Ken and Walt Peregoy, you'll know and you'll immediately understand why. From the time I started reading books about Disney, one of the things that most fascinated me were the people who were doing the pre-production work for those movies, the people, the concept artists that were drawing and drawing and drawing to inspire their colleagues, and really people like Ken Anderson and Walt Peregoy and so on and so forth,
right.
Which is why at some point, right after we moved to the U.S. in 2012, I started developing an idea in my mind, which is, you know, we should take each of those fantastic concept artists from Disney from the 1930s until today and really have like full bios of each of them that would really dig deep into their careers and also showcase a lot of their artwork that has not been seen before.
Sure.
Because we tend to see the exact same pieces from Ken Anderson, and we don't see much from Walt Peregoy and so on and so forth. I really wanted to go and dig deep into the Animation Research Library and the Disney Archives to bring to the fore a lot of artwork that had not been seen before and tell stories about those artists that had not been told before. And so what I realized is to do that, I needed to pitch to Chronicle Books, who had a Disney license and still has a Disney license. Mm-hmm. I needed to pitched to that publisher a series of art books, which ended up becoming the series They Drew As They Pleased, The Hidden Art of Disney, mm-hmm. Six art books, which covered the story of those incredible artists, who were not animators, who were not part of the Nine Old Men, but who are fantastic artists in their own right and who did all of that pre-production artwork. Right. And I started with Albert Herter, the first one of them. And then I go all the way to the 2020s with people who were very active in the 1990s and 2010s, people like Mike Giamo and Michael.
Mike Giamo
and Hans Backer and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And also Joe Grant, who was still active, obviously, in the 1990s, which was a beautiful way, obviously, to close the circle and go back to the 1930s while ending in the 2000s. And so that series was released over 6 years by Chronicle Books, mm-hmm. and 95% of the artwork in there had never, ever been seen in book form before.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful because, yeah, Disney tends to republish the same stuff all the time. And I guess it's easy access. And there's so much artwork in the archives that's absolutely beautiful. I had this little sketch, I don't know where it is, of O'Malley the Alley Cat from Aristocats. Ken Anderson did it. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, there were other people involved with the design, like Milt Kahl and all that. Milt Kahl finalized the design for animation, but the designs came from pretty much Ken Anderson, you know, and maybe some suggestions from story people. It's, you know, I don't want to underestimate the importance of Ken Anderson to Disney animation because, or Disney in general, because he was all around doing things on all different projects, mainly animation, but also in the parks as well. So the Haunted Mansion basically was, I think some of those sketches were from Ken Anderson in the beginning, designing the haunted house, correct?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. So Ken Anderson was an amazing, amazing talent. I don't think he knew how important he was to the studio, but he was tremendous. So we were talking about Joe Grant, right? And Joe Grant had left the studio. He was instrumental in the story of Dumbo, but he had worked on a bunch of different films early on and then left the studio. I think he went into a career in greeting cards.
That's right. He did greeting cards. He did ceramics, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And yes, for quite a few years, he was doing lots of other things.
Right. Absolutely. Did he came back to the studio in the 80s, right?
I would have to look up the exact date, but it's either the late 80s or the early 90s. But yeah. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Generally, yeah. I want to talk about some of the animators that worked at Disney back in the day that were important animators, but were not the nine old men, you know? There are people like Hal King and Eric Clayworth and... These are names that you see on the films. You know, Hal Ambrose was a great animator who worked on Lady and the Tramp, is doing a lot of the dogs there. And all these people that were producing a lot of work, but they were not considered the nine old men. They were talents in their own right. Is there any particular talent that you came across over like all the years of research that you found was like, you know, a very important talent that was not one of the nine old men, other than Ken Anderson?
Well, you obviously have quite a few amazing animators who were not part of the nine old men. So the two most obvious ones are Freddie Moore and Bill Tytler.
Right.
And Art Babbitt, obviously, also.
Yes.
To talk about some of the unsung talent, or at least the incredible talent that made the Walt Disney Studio and that aren't part of the nine old men. So yes, there were quite a few. I mean, again, the top ones would be Ham Lusk, Fred Moore, Bill Tytler, and Art Babbitt.
Yeah. Yeah, I was when I was watching Lady and the Tramp, I was actually also watching 101 Dalmatians the other night. And it's because I'm doing another podcast with somebody. We're talking about the design elements of this. But Bill Peet was an excellent story talent. He was a sketch guy, and he ended up leaving the studio and developing his own series of books. But he was instrumental to a lot of this stuff. But he had other people like Don DeGrotty and Joe Rinaldi, also very important to the studio. When you did your research, did you for like Walt's people, were you able to get some of these? Some stories or about some of these animators into those books?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there is in Walt's People, there is, for example, or there will be an interview with Bill Tytla, which is one of the only known interviews of Bill Tytla to be released. There are interviews with all sorts of not well-known Disney animators or assistants to famous animators. I mean, you have the quite a few of the assistants to Milt Gold, for example, which are featured in Walt's People. The whole idea of Walt's People is to try and gather basically every single interview ever conducted by a Disney artist who worked with Walt.
Right.
Those fantastic and fascinating interviews. And I just released volume 27 of Walt's People, means that it's now more than 10,000 pages of interviews. 10,000 pages of interviews.
Wow.
Released in that series,
right?
And counting, because I'm hard at work on volume 28 and 29, and there's a lot more to come.
What are some of the nuggets that are coming in like the next couple of volumes?
Well, there are quite a few things that have not been covered before, which are going to be featured, because the great thing, obviously, with that series is that, incredibly enough, I keep discovering new material all the time. So I'll give you a few examples. There was an animator who worked at Disney and then at a few other studios called Al Euster.
Yes.
I don't know how to pronounce that, but
Al Euster.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
And a good friend of mine told me that his diaries had survived. And so in volume 28 of Walt's People, I'm going to be releasing his diaries from his time at the Disney Studio from 1935 to 1939. There was a woman animator who served as assistant to Milt Gold in the 1940s, a person called Grace Hurt. And I recently rediscovered via her family that she had written a short autobiography. And so that autobiography is going to be released also in volume 28 of Walt's People.
Wow.
But there is a lot more. I mean, there's always more, incredibly enough, that's being little by little rediscovered. My good friend, the historian Ross Kerr, interviewed quite a few people who had not been interviewed, artists that both composers and also animators and so on and so forth. And he's finally digitizing his whole collection. And the idea is that we're going to release a special book just collecting all of his interviews and letters. There was an interview with Ivan Earle, the wonderful designer that obviously is famous for his design of the look and feel of Sleeping Beauty. And
yes.
I discovered an interview with him that was released in volume 27 of Walt's People. And of course, there are quite a lot of interviews with Imagineers, more recent artists, some who have not worked with Walt, but work with people who work with Walt.
Right.
Some that I've interviewed, some of my friends have interviewed. And I try to, when I do interview them, to really go very much in depth about their career and getting them to tell us all of the stories of all of the things they lived through and the interviews that they designed that did not get built and the ones that they designed that did get built,
right,
and all of the challenges along the way. So it's really fun to listen to all of those stories and to be able to share them with an audience who cares.
Yes. No, it's very fascinating. I know Ward Kimball kept a diary. I don't know where that was published. I don't know if that was a MIDI or.
So the diaries of Walt Kimball have not been released. Amida MIDI was working on a biography of Walt Kimball, which never got published, unfortunately, for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The Walt Kimball diaries are absolutely fascinating, but for a lot of different reasons, we haven't been able to release them yet. Maybe one day.
Yeah, because there's a lot of good stuff. He kept a daily diary, apparently, all those years. And
that's right. Not for all the years. He kept the diaries mostly from, I think, around 1938 to about 1947, 48, with some gaps in between.
Right.
But still. You have all of the monsters of the strike, for example, the Disney strike from 1941.
Yes, I know he documented that. Yes,
that's right.
Yeah, I think some of that might have been published in, I'm trying to think of some fan publication years ago, and I don't know.
That's right. You're absolutely correct.
Yes, yeah,
but it was.
Was it Persistence of Vision? Maybe.
No, it wasn't. It was in a magazine called the Comics Journal, and some of it was released in an interview with Ward. Ward actually read from those diaries for that interview.
Yes, they published a lot of stuff in there, and they had some recollections from people that worked at Turrytoons, and I guess one of the artists drew what the bullpen looked like, which looked like some bad schoolhouse, you know, with the animator's desk in a row. So there were a lot of interesting things in that publication. I remember reading that years ago. So I think that came out in the 70s, right? 70s or 80s?
That's right. But I think what you're thinking about in terms of the Terrytoon article, if I'm not mistaken, would be Funny World, the magazine released by Michael Barrier.
Mike Barrier, yeah. And Milton Gray, I think, was involved with that, right?
That's right. Or you might be thinking of Cartoonist Profiles.
That might be it. Boy, you got some brain there, I'll tell you. Or recalling all this stuff. Let's just talk about Disney animation in general. What's your favorite Disney animated film? And let's just say of all time, Disney animated film. It could be anything. It could be anything, even the computer generated stuff.
Well, there are really my two favorite ones are Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, not surprisingly, and The Jungle Book.
Yes.
Those are really my two favorite animated features from Disney. And then if we talk about characters, then it gets really funny because I'm going to tell you about some characters that are probably not very well known. And so I think my three favorite ones, one is well known, is the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, wonderful character. Ward Kimball again, Cheshire Cat.
That's right. And then two of my other favorite characters are the Araquan bird from the short Clown of the Jungle.
Yes.
Which is this completely crazy, crazy bird. And because he's from Brazil and because I just love the design of the character and so on and so forth, José Carioca is the other one.
Yes. Yeah.
But I'm biased. My wife is from Brazil. Not from Rio, but she's from Brazil.
Right. Well, I don't think it matters. Three Caballeros, I used to teach a class in animation, and I used to show the Three Caballeros on film. And the reason why I like the movie a whole lot, I tend to go more toward the 40s pictures, even though I love Jungle Book. I love a lot of different movies. I think 101 Dalmatians is very inventive. But as far as just really loving a movie, I really do like Three Caballeros a lot. And Ichabod and Mr. Toad, I really like a lot. So have you delved into the Disney live action output? Because I know we were talking before the podcast, we were talking about a book that you recently did about Disney's True Life Adventures. And I said something along the lines, I believe that kind of came out of all the footage that was shot as reference for the animators, where maybe that idea came up. What prompted you to do that book?
Well, what prompted me to do that book is that I always realized that the True Life Adventures were one of the projects that had not been very much discussed in books, history books before. Every time you would read about the True Life Adventures, you would find maybe one page posted the two pages about those projects. Mm-hmm. And they are incredibly rich projects. And the worst part is that in those one or two pages about those projects, you would often read stories that were repeated from other sources, which proved to be tall tales. Mm-hmm. There's this whole story about the origin of Seal Island, which was released in Reader's Digest at the time, mm-hmm. Around that same time, where Paul Milot, one of the cinematographers or the main cinematographer who worked on Seal Island, tells Reader's Digest that the way it happened is that Walt met him in Alaska, told him, "Al, I want you to go and shoot footage in Alaska." And Al says, "Well, what type of footage?" Walt says, "Well, everything you see, you know." And he says, "Well, I didn't really know, but I did it anyway." And then Walt saw the footage and said, "More seals." Well, it's a great story. It's a fun story.
Sure.
None of it is true, but it's a fun story.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, wouldn't it be fun to find the diaries of Al and Elma Milot? Wouldn't it be fun to get the real story? And the more I started digging, the more I realized it's not just the filming of Seal Island. It's not just the adventure for a full year in Alaska in 1946 in conditions that must have been incredibly harsh. It's not just the fact that Elma Milot, when she went with her husband there, was pregnant, which made it even more incredible.
Yes.
It's the fact that there is a whole story that starts way earlier, that starts in the late 1930s, that leads to that. And the story starts with really research, as you suspected, on Bambi, where Walt Disney says, well, to inspire my artists, I need to show them not just footage of deer in motion and not just like live deer. What I also need to do is I need to show them what the backgrounds could look like. And for that, I need pictures of real forest in Maine. Mm-hmm. And so he has an artist at the time called Jake Day, who's from Maine and who's a great photographer, and Walt, who knows a lot about all of his artists, discovers that about Jake Day. And he says, "Jake, I'm going to send you to Maine, and I want you to come back with photos of the woods of Maine that you know so well." And Jake says, "Yeah, that's great." And what I discovered during the research is that Jake Day went there with a friend of his who wasn't working for the Walt Disney Studios. And the two of them went there and spent months in the woods of Maine and shot all of those pictures. What's great about that is that friend of his kept a diary. And so the first chapter of the book is really based on his diary. And you see them like reading the script of Bambi. You see them like looking for that perfect place where Bambi would be born. And then there's the photo of the meadow where Bambi is born, and you can immediately picture in your mind the scene in Bambi with Bambi basically being born and the side of his mother, and it is the exact same meadow really as the one in the picture, and so it's just great fun to retrace all of those steps.
Right. It's amazing with Disney history. You start delving into it. And then you start finding out bits and pieces, and it just keeps leading to more and more and more. And that's kind of the fun of it, going back into this research. You think everything has been documented already between all these years, you know, the last 50 years of, you know, between the art of animation to now, and there's still more stuff to dig up, which is incredible.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, just to give one more example, a very recent example, with two friends of mine, fellow Disney historians, Ted Thomas, the son of Frank Thomas, the animator, one of the Nine Old Men, mm-hmm. and then J.B. Kaufman, who you mentioned earlier. We teamed up to write a full account of the trip to Latin America in 1941, a day-by-day account of that trip, fully illustrated, with more than 200 photographs from that trip. And it was just great to work on that. And that's now in layout phase and ready to be released, hopefully, later this year. But you're like, okay, now that this is done, is there anything else to find out about those trips to Latin America? And then what you realize is quite a bit had already been written about the trip to Latin America in 1941, even though our work goes a lot deeper and shows a lot more things and shares a lot more information. But there were later trips. There were trips in 1942, in 1943 to Mexico, and then a trip in 1944 to Cuba. And so just as recently as yesterday evening, I was piecing that whole jigsaw puzzle together and focusing on that trip to Mexico City in 1942, to Mexico in 1942, and trying to get a day-by-day understanding of what they did. And I realized that there's still a lot to be discovered. There's still a lot to be investigated. And it's just sheer fun.
It is. There, Ted Thomas, who's Frank Thomas's son, did a film about the trip to South America, which is El Grupo.
That's right. You did.
Grupo, mm-hmm. And which I think is, I'm not sure if it's on Disney Plus. I've seen it, but I'd like to see it again. I'd like to watch it again just to kind of refresh my memory on all the places they did and went to and all the things that they did while they were down there. I know they were sketching, as soon as the plane landed, they were sketching.
Yes, that's right. And again, you'll have a chance both if you rewatch the documentary, but also if you buy that new monograph that we will release towards the end of this year, mm-hmm. you'll get a chance to relive that whole trip with them in a lot of details and to really follow their route on the map and see the places they saw at the time. And more important, see lots and lots and lots of photographs of that trip that no one had seen before in book form.
Oh, going to look forward to that. What's the is there any holy grail, meaning is there any book that you would like to do that you'd really like to find out information, like some information that's eluded you? Is there
anything? Yes.
What would that be?
And I will tell you exactly what it is. This is for me the absolute holy grail. So
because maybe this will, you never know when you throw something out. You never know what's going to come back at you, So somebody may contact you from this podcast and say, I got what you're looking for, because I know that happens.
Well, here is both one of the most interesting projects and also one of the most frustrating, elusive documents ever. So the project is really a project that J.D. Kaufman, David Gernstein, another historian, and myself would like to tackle one day, which is a full in-depth history of the making of the Disney shorts from the 1930s. This is something that, and both the produced and unproduced Disney shorts from the 1930s.
Right.
That we would really like to do one day. It would be either one book or several books, but we need to finally write that history. The issue, though, is we have quite a bit of material on the produced Disney shorts, but we want to also be as complete as we can on the unproduced shorts. Mm-hmm. And we know, I actually discovered about 5, 6, 7 years ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, one document which originally was a 35-page document that listed all of the unproduced Disney shorts that had moved to storybook phase. That had moved to storyboard phase,
right?
And with a synopsis, and with dates at which they had started the storyboard process, and also who was the story team working on that project at the time. Wow. The issue, though, is that when I discovered that document, mm-hmm. I only located 10 pages out of the 35.
Right,
and I'm not sure if the rest of the document exists somewhere. It's not at the Disney archives.
Right.
And we have not been able to locate the missing 25 pages until now. It's a document from September 1939. Mm-hmm. And it's utterly fascinating. And the most frustrating part is we know a lot of the projects that were listed in there, but there are two that are missing that I know are listed in some of the other pages with synopsis. And one is a sequel to the band concert, the first Mickey Mouse short in color.
Oh, wow.
And the other one is a sequel to The Country Cousin, the famous Silly Symphony.
Yes.
But we don't know anything about those other two projects. We know there was a sequel. Mm-hmm. We know in the missing pages from that document, there would have been the synopsis from those sequels.
Right.
But those pages are missing. And so it's incredibly frustrating because without that holy grail, it's impossible to really write that full, in-depth, complete history of the Disney short from the 1930s. But then who knows? Maybe one day. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day. The one thing I've been fascinated about, and I'm just talking about the Disney live-action films from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, is, you know, a lot of people think that they were either shot at Golden Oak up in Santa Clarita, which would be like Old Yeller, stuff like that, you know, Darby O'Gill. And they shot a lot of stuff on the Disney backlot. I know I'm changing gears here a little bit, but it's kind of in the same vein with Disney history. And I've just recently found out that a lot of things that were shot weren't just shot at Disney. They shot stuff over at the Universal lot. They shot stuff at the Burbank, Warner Brothers lot. They basically used whatever they could use, but they would try to keep it in-house. They tried to use everything in the studio and in the back lot, the Golden Oak lot. But, and a lot of times, like with Absent-Minded Professor, they shot around the studio streets, you know, so you pass by, they would use the animation building as a college, you know. But there were a lot of things that were shot around the streets in Burbank, you know, and they didn't really go too far away from the studio to shoot, with the exception of like, Swiss Family Robinson, where they basically went somewhere else to shoot it to get the exotic look. But I would love to see a book where every film they kind of really nail it as far as where all these films were shot, just because I love those films. And maybe you don't agree with me, but some people may think they're hokey, but I love them. I love them as a kid, so I have a lot of nostalgic value there to me. So.
Oh, I grew up watching them as a kid, and I absolutely loved them. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. And by the way, obviously, at the opposite end of the spectrum of those live-action movies that were shot in California, they are those the live-action movies that were shot in the UK to use the block walls in the early 1950s.
That's right. You know, a lot of the English Disney films were shot in Britain. They were shot at a lot of stuff was shot at I don't know if it was Shepperton. Was it Shepperton Studios? They had a backlot over there. Or
no, I can't remember the name of the studio, but it's not Shepperton.
Okay.
If I'm mistaken, the name of the studio eludes me right now, but I know it's another studio.
Right.
But yes, and we're preparing a series of monographs on the making of those movies, British movies.
Do you remember what the last British movie that was shot by Disney?
I don't. I don't
either.
I don't know if it's The Sword in the Rose or if it's Robin Hood, the story of Robin Hood and his merry men. I would have to look. I do not remember which one it was.
I know they shot one in the 70s called Ride a Wild Pony. I'm pretty sure that was either an acquisition that they recut, because I think Don Chaffee was the director who directed a lot of Disney films, but he directed Pete's Dragon. But I remember it not being – it didn't resemble any film that would have been produced in the United States by Disney. And as far as the British films, I think Grey Friars Bobby, maybe, or they were still doing some stuff in the 60s that were British films. So,
Yes, absolutely. No, I was really thinking of the very first, and again, I'm not sure if it's Rob Roy or one of the others. And yes, you're right. Grey Friars Bobby was shot obviously in close to in Scotland. So yeah, you're right, in the early 1960s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really examined that too much, but it's just, you know, I'm just thinking back on these productions because they don't look like in name only, they're Disney productions, maybe story-wise, but they don't seem like Disney productions in-house. There's a whole different feel to – I know like Incredible Journey was shot in Canada, and we're talking about the 1963 version. Yeah. And it was totally shot in Canada. I mean, there were a lot of the Disney productions that were shot in Canada, and they had – I think it was Calgary Limited was the name of the studio that shot a lot of these things, and they did a lot of TV stuff too. But Disney productions weren't just solely in-house. They would farm stuff out. As far – let's go back into the Disney theme parks. What's your favorite attraction – out of all the theme parks, is there any particular one, and why?
Yeah, the one I prefer is Splash Mountain, which unfortunately is going away. Yeah. And why? Just because of the sheer number of audio animatronics, and also because of just the sheer surprise the first time I wrote it. When you think it's done, you're at the end of the attraction, and then it goes back to life, and it's even more amazing and even more outstanding. And obviously the fact that that those audio animatronics, all of them had a real marvelous history attached to them and came from another attraction.
That's so right.
It's just fascinating from my standpoint. And obviously it's Tony Baxter who worked on that, and he's one of my favorite Imagineers. So, yeah.
He is. One of my favorite attractions, I love when I rode Splash Mountain, the attraction came online at Disneyland. I was able to ride it, and it was fun. That was not just because of the ride itself, but the animatronics in it and the storyline. Really a fun ride. I don't think the route is going to change. I think it's just they're going to theme it with other animatronics that are more to Princess and the Frog. So probably not going to change all that much. Just a little set dressing and maybe a few new characters in there. All those characters came from America Sings, which was came after the Carousel of Progress, which was a very neat attraction over in Tomorrowland.
And designed by another wonderful animator, trained Imagineer, Mark Davis.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, well, I don't, like I said, I don't think that the animatronics are going away. I think they're just going to kind of like get a new coat of paint or whatever on those things, new dressings. I love the Haunted Mansion. I really love the Haunted Mansion for the design, the theming, and a lot of animatronics in there too. A lot of nice spooky effects in there. So, still a favorite. So with the upcoming book, what's the next book that is coming? Is there one coming out now?
Let me mention two projects that are coming out very soon. So one, she's coming out towards the end of the year, is the one I mentioned earlier, is the Walt Disney and El Grupo in Latin America, this day-by-day account of the trip to Latin America. And then the other one that will come out at some point next year, and in fact, I should say the other ones, it's a series of either two or three monographs on Mickey Mouse in the 1930s on stage and on radio.
Okay, Let's say this again because I lost you. So the next book is the Mickey Mouse book.
So the one that will be released towards the end of this year is the book I was mentioning earlier about Walt Disney and El Grupo in Latin America.
Okay.
About the 1941 trip to Latin America.
All right.
And then the one that will be released at some point next year is a book I'm writing with another historian called E.B. Spatz. And that will be a series of two or three books about two or three monographs about Mickey Mouse on stage and on radio in the 1930s, which is a subject matter that has never been really discussed before. And we have dug up so much new material, so much, that initially we thought this would be one volume, one monograph. And then we realized, no, with so many illustrations that no one has ever seen before, so many new information, so many great letters and diaries and things like that, this is going to be two volumes. And wow. Now we're actually at the point where it's like we're discovering still so much that we're thinking it might actually be three volumes.
Wow.
And it's going to be, it's going to revolutionize the way we see Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. It's going to revolutionize our understanding of the history of Mickey in the 1930s. We knew Mickey was famous, was a star in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. I had no idea, honestly, that he was such a star in the 1930s.
Right.
And not just in the U.S., but everywhere around the world. It is mind-boggling. It is just something that again, is going to make your eyes go, oh, my God.
Sounds great. How many books do you have out now on have you calculated this? Have you totaled them all up? Are they in the hundreds or no? How many books?
No, the books that I've written, nine books about Disney plus the ones that are coming in the next few years. Mm-hmm. I think I'm working on five different projects in terms of writing new books.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of the books, if I add the books that I've edited, like the Waltz People book series or the book about Eric Larson and so on and so forth, yes. I think I'm at 46 at the moment.
46. That's a, wow. Okay. Wow. So much information. I'm glad you're able to compile all this stuff and get it out. And I urge everybody to, if you haven't seen these books, they're available, what, on Amazon? Amazon has them. That's where I picked up the Eric Larson book. And originally when we're going to do this, we're going to talk about Eric Larson a little bit and talk about this book. I think it's a wonderful book, 50 Years in the Mouse House. And it's basically a compilation of lectures by Eric Larson and I guess some daily notes that he would make through time. There's also a foreword by I believe it's Bernie Mattinson, who did a little bit in here, right?
And that's right, Brian. And even more than all of that, it's also the lost autobiography of Eric Larson. That was the thing that I was really looking for at the beginning. Is I knew that he had written an autobiography, and I really wanted to find it. And so I ended up, thanks to my good friend and co-author Joe Campana, we ended up tracking down the younger brother of Eric Larson, who was in his late 90s.
Wow.
And when we contacted him, he returned our call a few days later. And he said, you know, I might actually have the papers that you're looking for. And those papers were in an old red suitcase, which was about to be thrown away.
Wow.
And we were right in the nick of time. We found those documents, and we found the lost autobiography of Eric Larson, and a lot more, obviously, as you described earlier.
Oh, it's a wonderful book going through this. It's great for anybody interested in the Disney history, because Eric Larson was a part of that. He was very important to the studio back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and especially in the 70s, because he trained all these people that were working on these pictures like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. Just everybody has some story about working with Eric or training with Eric. And I even talked with Eric Larson when I was trying to get into animation. I was able to have a nice little conversation with him. He's a wonderful gentleman. And so I want to thank you for doing this book, 50 Years in the Mouse House. And I just thought this came out. This came out in 2015, which is 8 years. Jeez, 8 years. And I'm embarrassed because I thought this book had just come out. So anyway, but thank you for writing or compiling all this information into one book. I appreciate it. Didier, you have any last comments about Walt Disney that you can impart to our listeners here?
just that there is always more to discover, and that that it's not just Walt, it's Walt and his artist, and he was really a genius, but his artists are also really worth knowing and discovering and studying in detail.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you for coming on here, and where can they can get the books through Amazon. Is there anywhere else that they can find the books? You have the Disney History blog. So do you know the website address for that? And
Yes, the Disney History blog is disneybooks.blogspot.com. Okay. Disneybooks.blogspot.com.
Okay, disneybooks.blogspot.com. And your books are available on Amazon. Is there any other place you can get them? Or?
Sure. Some of them are also available, even signed via Stuart Ng Books, so Stuart Ng Books in Los Angeles. And you'll find some of them autographed.
Oh, wow. Cool. Didier, thank you for coming on here. And I really appreciate your time. I hope you have a great afternoon and a wonderful Disney day.
Thank you so much, Brian. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, take care now. Have a good one now.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Hey, thank you, Didier. I just want to let everybody know that the Cartoonerific podcast is now on Facebook. Basically, we have a page on Facebook. So it's Cartoonerific, Classic Anime Cartoons. And so we have links from there to the podcast, but there's also other things that we link to, which are pieces of animation or some news or whatever. If we find out about stuff, we'll pop it on there for you to check it out. So anyway, the Cartoonerific Classic Anime Cartoon page on Facebook, please follow us. If you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. Go to your favorite service and click the subscribe button, and you will be notified every time a brand new Cartoonerific podcast is uploaded for your enjoyment. Also, please tell a friend, tell two, tell three, tell your cartoon buddies all about us. It's so important. Anyway, just want you to know, I really appreciate that you're coming back here and you're listening to these podcasts. I hope you're enjoying them. They're done out of a lot of love. So anyway, hope to see you next week. Take care now.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.